Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A super storm and a super toll. 90-plus dead now in the blast of Sandy, maybe $50 billion in losses, lives, businesses turned upside down. Heartbreak, heroism, and big questions about how much a big urbanized coastline can take and how often. Last year, Irene, now Sandy, both monster storms. This hour on Point, survivor stories and lessons learned from Sandy. You can join the conversation. Has it hit you? How? Can you believe the images? What are we dealing with here? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Scene after scene and sight after sight up and down the East Coast. When the hurricane was at its height, fire broke out in Queens, the neighborhood of Breezy Point. By the time firefighters got there, water pipes bursting, no pressure in the hydrants. 110 houses went up in the flames, dozens more destroyed by flooding. Breezy Point resident Kevin McQuillan described the devastation there.
It's just ungodly. I mean, I came down and I expected the worst, and it's 10 times worse than I expected. There are houses off their moorings sitting in the walkway.
Across the Hudson River from New York City, the community of Hoboken, New Jersey, especially hard hit. On Wednesday, Mayor Don Zimmer pleaded for help.
We need more food. We need more resources. So anyone who's listening to this in the city of Hoboken or neighboring towns who can get to us, we ask you to come and deliver your supplies.
Please, she says. And in New York, when a backup generator failed, patients evacuated from New York University Hospital, among them Julia Alemany, who had just gone into labor. Her husband, Doron, described the scene.
They took her off the bed, got her on this med sled, and proceeded to slide her really slowly down 8 flights of stairs. There was a lot of screaming going on. There were about 6 people with newborns. Like, there would be a group of 6 people with oxygen tank and other medical attachments to this baby trying to get by us to get down more quickly than us.
Scene after scene, people bouncing back, but also real despair. New York Senator Chuck Schumer got an earful from frustrated residents when he toured devastated Staten Island on Thursday. Donna Soli didn't mince words.
We have no cars. Don't you see? We need the, but please, President Obama,
yes.
Please listen
yes, no.
to us down here. We are going to die. You don't understand. You got to get your trucks here on this corner now.
We will go to New York and New Jersey today, the heart of the Sandy hit, though we know it's wider, too, and we're happy to hear from you. 800-423-TALK, 800-423-8255. Joining us now from Lower Manhattan is Jim Axelrod, national correspondent for CBS News. He's been there all week covering the crisis hitting the city. Jim Axelrod, thank you very much for taking a minute out to talk to us. Where are you? What have you seen?
Hi, Tom. It's really good to be with you. I'm actually standing in front of the Southbury Station, Whitehall Street Station of New York subway, where it's been an incredible week here. I was down in this subway station just a couple of days ago. You'll have to forgive me. They really have all run together.
Yeah.
And we were taken down there by a guy named Joe Leader, who handles maintenance issues for the MTA. And it looked, again, like you've heard a gazillion times this week, like something out of a disaster movie. There were pilings from other docks down in a New York City subway station, piles from the wall ripped off. We went down to the escalators, and 3 steps down, you could see water. And I asked Joe how far down it went. He said 2 more stories. So it seems that people just haven't seen at any point, you know, these guys who've been doing their jobs 20, 25, 30 years running the subways, say they've just never not only seen anything like this, never anticipated this being a possibility.
All that water coming ashore in this very, very big storm. Jim, what about transportation at this point? I know you've been covering it. How much of the New York subway system is up and running? How much is still on the blink, swamped?
Well, I think 16 out of 27 lines are running right now, and all the bus service is beginning to come back. It has been probably the single most important thing was to get the mass transit system in some even limited fashion up and running, because that has eased some of the stress. There's been enormous congestion on the city roads. There continues to be. Tom, I can't stress enough that what everyone is waiting for in Lower Manhattan is for Con Ed to get the power turned back on. I'm looking at three different Con Ed crews right where I am working on Transformers. The hope is to have power back on in Lower Manhattan by tomorrow morning. 227,000 people still without power here.
I mean, and those people very often in high-rise buildings with only apartment with elevators and stairs, and only stairs when the juice isn't on. You got people kind of stranded, Jim, in the sky.
Yeah, well, they are. Although a lot of people got out with the mayor very early on, Michael Bloomberg said, "Look, there's a zone where you're going to all be in trouble. There's about 375,000 people, and we are asking you all to leave." I would say a good portion of those folks heeded the warnings, but it has been a wild scene at night. I mean, Tom, it's like, I feel like I've spent a week in that movie Escape from New York. You drive around at night, and there are no traffic signals, there's no streetlights, and you become very aware of how tenuous sort of the fabric, the social fabric is. It feels that sense of, like, anarchy is right around the corner if they don't get the lights on. Because everything, once you're dealing and living in darkness and without electricity and power, you realize just how sort of used to all the conveniences of modern life we've all become so accustomed to.
Well, Jim, what about that? How severely do you see New York City? We'll get beyond New York, but New York City is having been tested this week. It's a tough city. It's a survivor city. But all cities have a fragility. They depend on all kinds of infrastructure, with those flooded tunnels and all the rest. And how big a challenge was Sandy to the life of New York this week?
You know what, Tom? It was like two different cities. There was Lower Manhattan, and it would be so odd as we would drive up 6th Avenue, you'd get to about 23rd or 24th Street moving north, and suddenly you would see the lights, traffic lights would come on, and it was literally like the demarcation line. You would cross out of one New York and into the other, and we would find people at Grand Central Station who would walk 25 and 30 blocks just to charge their cell phones. So a lot of this had to do with, I guess, what you would term inconvenience. But that was sort of in Manhattan. It's the breezy points in Queens, and it's Staten Island, and, you know, it's the Hoboken, New Jersey's, where those people were facing real devastation. In New York, and what I've seen in Lower Manhattan, I would rope it into significant disruption, but not the devastation that those other folks have been facing.
And what about in Lower Manhattan there? Talk from Governor Cuomo, from Mayor Bloomberg, about New York needing big, high, new seawalls against that kind of storm surge. Does it look like an obvious need?
Well, if you saw what we saw the other night, I it would be hard to argue against that, although I suppose if these are 100-year events, I'm sure that'll become quite the political issue. But Tom, take a look from a week like this. In addition to this sort of, you know, we live in this on-demand world, and capital the on-demand world. Man, there was no demanding anything. There was just existing. But I was just talking to a restaurant owner waiting to, classic American story. Guy's a busboy at the Plaza Hotel for 5 years when he comes over from Montenegro 40 years ago, and now he has 12 restaurants. And one of them sits right on the harbor in Lower Manhattan. And he's got 40 feet of water, below him because he's actually over the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. And I look at him, I go, "What are you going to do?" He goes, "You kidding me? I got a wedding tomorrow night. If they get the power on in the morning, I'm having a wedding here tomorrow night." But there's also that spirit in the city as well.
Absolutely. New York, get the power on and get going again. But these are real challenges, 100-year events. Back-to-back with Irene and now Sandy. Jim Axelrod with CBS News, national correspondent all over Lower Manhattan this week. Jim, thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom, always a pleasure.
Here's New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg yesterday at City Hall talking about the city's loss and its road to recovery.
We have found a few more deceased, and once again, our hearts go out to them. But what we've got to do is recover for their families and make sure that this city and those they left behind have a future.
City's got to have a future. Ellis Hennekin joins us right now, columnist at Newsday. He's in New York City. I think, Ellis, your home's in Tribeca. Have you lived there this week or fled?
A little bit of both, actually. It's just been so creepy in our neighborhood. One of the first things that struck me was, did you realize it gets dark at night in New York? We've experienced that for the first time this week.
Right. Just the simple fact of darkness. Listen, all the way up here in Boston, I had no power all week long, so I know how early it gets dark. But New York is the city that never sleeps. The lights are never supposed to go off, but they did.
That's right. And that first night, of course, I'm sitting with my wife in the apartment, and you know, eventually we get bored, right? We've got no TV, no computer, and we're both interesting people. But you know, after a while, that gets a little tiresome. So we take the walk, and it's the dog walkers who are out first. Okay, mm-hmm. They're the ones who are on the sidewalk first.
Must.
But as we crept around the cobblestone streets of Tribeca, it truly was unlike anything I have ever seen in New York. Little flashlights walking along, mm-hmm. doggies barking, and people just kind of feeling their way down Hudson and Greenwich streets. It was, you know, on one hand, it was kind of weird and fun. On the other hand, you thought, hey, this better not last very long.
And the sound of all that water sloshing underneath in the subway tunnels, in the tunnels to get people into Manhattan, that's a challenge to New York City infrastructure, Ellis.
That is right. And it reminds us how much we are dependent on those tunnels, and especially on that subway system. The sidewalks so crowded. This city does not work without its subways.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the week of Sandy, survivor stories, damage done, lessons learned in the superstorm. Ellis Hennekin is with us from New York City, columnist at Newsday. We will go in just a moment to New Jersey, where the devastation was so great. The commute from Long Island to New York City is never for the faint of heart. Yesterday, one brave soul, Tim McDonough, described his first drive in since the hurricane.
This is the first time we got in. I left us about quarter to five this morning. 59th Street Bridge, disaster. I feel bad for people on that. Disaster. But they'll get in. We're all survivors.
Scarce gas means mile-long backups at the pumps in New Jersey. Frustrated drivers here talking yesterday to CBS News.
I've been online for gas for almost 2 hours.
I've been waiting here for 3 hours now, and whole time on the parkway, people have been trying to cut in, so I'm really happy the state police are out there.
Ellis, we'll go to New Jersey. You're in New York City, the city as we have known it. Does it work in the era that we appear maybe to be in now, where 100-year events come more often? Irene last year, Sandy this year. Does this city need some kind of new face, new infrastructure, hardened subways to make it work, Ellis?
Yes, and we're already beginning the question of what do we do about this? If you believe, like most people in this city believe this week, that these occurrences are not like they used to be, that they're more intense and they're coming more often, and if those 100-year storms are coming every year or two, we really do have to wrestle with what is it that we do going forward to protect ourselves from this. You know, we can have political debates about whether climate change is causing it or just some freakish coincidence. But when you've got water in your subways and water in your basements and water in your streets, and it's happening more often than it's ever happened before, tough questions have to be faced about what do we do about it.
And it gets right into the grain of life. Catherine writes to us here. She says she's wondering about all the people who live in the subway tunnels around New York, imagining the bodies of those that may be found as the water recedes. What about the underground picture there, Ellis? How good a picture do you have of it? How deep the damage? How long before it's all up and running and the juice flowing again?
Well, thankfully, there are not too many people living in the subway tunnels anymore. The 20 years ago, we had a lot more of that than we do now. But listen, Tom, like anything, these things affect those without resources more intensely than they affect folks who have bucks. You know, wealthier people in Lower Manhattan are many staying in hotels and camping with friends other places. But people who don't have the ability to do that, they're the ones who are in the shelters and are sitting in lobbies overnight and finding places of refuge wherever they can.
I mean, you've got big citywide impacts, the mayor bringing on the New York Marathon, a controversy about that, but also very individual impacts. Phyllis writes to us here, Ellis, on Facebook. She says, my dearest friend died suddenly Sunday morning. In Jewish tradition, the funeral is supposed to take place ASAP. However, As the storm hit, she was taken first to a hospital, then to a funeral home. The funeral is scheduled for today, Friday, but no power at the funeral home. Now it's on for Sunday. We hope and pray it can happen then. Phyllis writes, she says, how many other funerals have been impacted? To add to the grief of the loss is the horror of not being able to bury your loved one. I mean, the most intimate grain of life gets thrown upside down with all this, Ellis.
That's right. And of course, it's not just funerals. Life goes on, whether we have one of these storms and its aftermaths or not, right? I mean, we heard about that man ready for the wedding tomorrow night at his restaurant downtown. Yeah. And, you know, all of us are going through life. People get sick and kids need stuff. And it just makes it all a lot harder.
Let's get our listeners in here. Leah calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Leah, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What have you seen?
Well, I actually decamped to Cambridge, as you mentioned, but I had been, my apartment is on 14th and 1st in the East Village in Manhattan, and so I'd sort of been, you know, hopping from place to place, and, you know, some without power and some with, but I decided that, you know, it was a little too challenging, so I came back to Cambridge, but I thought that the bus ride would be kind of difficult getting out of Manhattan and then relatively easy as it was yesterday morning. But in fact, it was relatively easy getting out of Manhattan, and then we endured an 8-hour bus ride, much of which was through Connecticut. So that was kind of a surprise for me.
Well, I mean, plenty of traffic, plenty of downed trees and all the rest. And what have you heard about the Manhattan you left behind? Are your friends heading back into their apartments there at this point, Leah, or still in the dark or out or what?
A lot of them are still walking around, walking uptown, walking down to Brooklyn to try and get power. I think that one of the most difficult challenges that we've faced is, you know, the dissemination of information, not knowing when will we actually have power and which sources are really credible with this. So that's been kind of a challenge.
Leah, good luck with your apartment there in Lower Manhattan. We hope you get back safe and sound. Let's go to New Orleans. They know something about big, big storms. Myron's calling from New Orleans. Hi, Myron, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. This is Myron Kath in New Orleans.
Hi.
Welcome to New Orleans.
Yeah.
I have a little building science company in New Orleans, and we proposed a city council ordinance that passed the year after Katrina, which gives homeowners a gold star for building what we call a truly sustainable home. And it, besides all the other things that people call sustainable, our homes protect the people in the home, and that means it has all the electricity, food, and water to last a week. And we'd like to see it in the building code for all buildings in the country, because not only would it protect people in this time period where we think in New Orleans almost 1,000 people died after the storm.
Yep.
Because they couldn't get the food or couldn't get the water. And maybe something, hopefully, God forbid, might happen where Sandy hit. I hope not.
Myron, I see how you might do that for a house, but how do you do it for a whole big city that sits right on the water, the biggest city in the country, New York?
Well, it's really, really very easy. It turns out less than 10 to 20 kilowatt hours of storage in a home that is reasonably energy conserving, or some people call energy efficient, would run the refrigerator and lights for a week.
Myron, we get your advice there. It's like, be prepared. Ellis, what about that citywide for New York City? Can you take on a superstorm Sandy with enough advanced preparation to say we're fine? Is that ever going to be possible?
Well, not entirely. I mean, clearly there's some stuff that you can do and some stuff that many people did. Lots of folks left that Zone A areas closest to the water. People did get flashlights and some food in the house. But listen, in the end, nature's going to win these fights. I mean, we can't hold the water back. We can't stop the winds. We can prepare ourselves as well as possible. But hold on tight, because it's not going to be fun for the next few days.
Gisela's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Gisela, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Quite back yet?
You're on. What's your story?
My story is that my disabled friend, Crystal, in the middle of the day yesterday, has a disabled friend in New York. We just came back from driving 6 hours there to walk up 12 flights of stairs, to walk back down and drive 5 hours back in order to deliver multiple marine batteries so that this man, who I've never met, but he's a friend of Crystal's, could power his ventilator, because he's got no power and FEMA couldn't help, the Red Cross wouldn't help. They couldn't even get him down 12 flights of stairs.
But you went up 12 flights of stairs with batteries for his ventilator. How did it look, Tribeca, the part of the city you were in? How did it look, Gisela?
Tribeca looked creepy and eerie. If you imagined going into New York in the dark. I didn't even know I was in Union Square until I looked and I saw ABC Carpet and Home that I recognized.
Right.
There's lining both sides of the street military vehicles in the pitch darkness. The only lights are my car lights. And my car lights are lighting the reflectors on the armed National Guard vests.
Wow. So your car lights, the light of New York City in that little microcosm. But bless you, Gisela, heading down to Tribeca to help a guy who needed batteries for his ventilator and really nobody else there to do it at that moment. Lots of folks from hurricane zones calling in here. West Palm Beach, Florida. Thanks, Gisela. Francis, thanks for calling from West Palm Beach. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Prior to the 2004 hurricane season here in South Florida, I was living with my aunt, who was 88 at the time, with mm-hmm. her pets. And being one or two generation Floridians, we've prided ourselves on always being ready and the best storm shutters and everything. And she was in agreement, my aunt, about evacuating if we had to. Then the 2005 season came. We didn't have to in 2004. We did okay. Then Wilma was coming, and so I, you know, started the conversation again about if we have to evacuate, if we're told, because we're not far from the ocean. We're in the
yep.
US-1. And my aunt said, no, I will not evacuate. I will not. I can't. If we get stuck in the car, she was having urinary problems.
Yeah. Did she survive? How did it work out?
We did all right. We had a big live oak branch fall on the roof and scared her to death, but we did fine. But when I hear people saying things about people who didn't heed warnings, there are people who try or can't or don't have the means, and I didn't know what to do. Was I to call the police and have them drag her out of the house to evacuate?
Yeah. No, point taken, Francis. So, evacuation is not so easy either. And we had big evacuation warnings here in New York City, beyond in New Jersey. I want to get there, Francis. Thanks for the report from West Palm. Very scary moments all over New Jersey. Here's a little bit early Tuesday morning. Hundreds forced out of their homes when a levee broke. Interview here with NBC News. One man describing what happened inside his home in the town of Little Ferry.
This is the scariest experience of my life. When you wake up, you call 911, you call the police, and it's busy. You have no one to go to. Water's rushing in, water's going by, and you don't know what to do.
You don't know what to do. Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey here in Brigantine on Wednesday telling residents they have to be strong in the face of the damage caused by Sandy.
We cannot permit that sorrow to replace the resilience that I know all New Jerseyans have. And so we will get up. And we'll get this thing rebuilt, and we'll put things back together, because that's what this state is all about and always has been all about.
But that's going to be a big job. We've all seen the images of the Jersey Shore and beyond. Ellis Hennigan, standby in New York. With us right now from Newark, New Jersey, Amy Nutt, staff writer for the Star-Ledger. She's been looking at gas shortages and power losses caused by the hurricane. Amy, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Hi, Tom.
Hi. And with us from northern New Jersey, Kate Zernike's here, national correspondent for the New York Times. Been reporting on the impact of Hurricane Sandy all over New Jersey. Kate covered Hurricane Katrina back in 2005. Kate Zernike, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Amy, any relief in sight for those long, long lines we've seen just to get gasoline, or is that still the situation in your area, Amy?
It's really rather critical. There's been no relief in sight. I was out actually at 3:30 this morning trying to find gas for my own car. And there are lines that form at stations that ran out of gas days ago. Just in the hope that, a tanker will make a delivery. I passed one line along the Garden State Parkway that was 141 cars long. This is, hours
wow.
long for
yeah.
people at the end. But 75%, we believe 75% of the gas stations are without electricity in New Jersey.
And Kate, you've been looking all over New Jersey. I mean, these images we see of the coast just look like horrific devastation there. And then we hear about roads out, bridges out, chemical tanks off their bases, and all the pollution that comes along with that. I mean, how deep is New Jersey's hole that Sandy's put it in here?
Oh, I think it's huge. I mean, particularly along the shore, there's just sort of this, it's almost as though the shore and entire towns and bridges just suddenly drop off into the water. And you see these aerial photos where it's just, you know, houses surrounded by water and, you know, driving along Route 35, which is sort of one of the main roads along the shore. I mean, there are just places where, you know, you just suddenly get wildly detoured because there's a house in the middle of the road and there are boats all over. And it's just, I mean, it's devastating. And, but the thing is, I drove from the shore to Trenton and then up sort of along the, through sort of central New Jersey and then back up into northern New Jersey into the suburbs. And everywhere there was devastation everywhere, in towns dark in central and northern New Jersey, trees and suburbs that have just ripped up entire sidewalks. The situation you mentioned earlier in Little Ferry and Munaki in northern New Jersey, it was actually not a levee that broke. The tidal surge was so high that it went over the New Jersey Turnpike up near the stadium where the Jets and Giants play.
Yeah.
And people did. I mean, as you heard from that one snippet, people just suddenly found their, you know, sat up in bed and saw that there was water on the floor.
Amy, we've seen a lot of people helping people, but also tempers flaring here in these huge long lines. I mean, how are people holding it together?
With difficulty. I think everybody is aware, in a way much more so than Irene, of the sort of very much the statewide situation. And because of Irene, I think a lot of New Jerseyans realize, you know, we're in it for the long haul. But there have been, you know, reports of fights breaking out on long gas lines. And, you know, it's a little bit better to the south of New Jersey along the Turnpike and the Garden State Parkway. But there's a 50 to 60 mile stretch where it's almost impossible to get gas.
That is a long, long stretch. We've got a caller here from Cape May, New Jersey. Joey is calling in. Hi, Joey. Thanks for calling in. What do you see?
Hi, Todd. How you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, I have an observation to make here. I was in Japan during the tsunami there. And in a single day, you had 20,000 people wiped off the earth, as well as cities and towns totally, completely destroyed and swept out to sea. I'd like to make an observation. It's kind of disappointing when you hear about people fist fighting in lines for gasoline, because over there in the dead of winter, not even the fall, the dead of winter, you had old, young alike, Japanese standing in line patiently, because they understood the fact that in situations of this nature, you need to put the self aside and worry about the whole, worry about the community, worry about the people, put anything partisan aside, and just worry about how everyone's going to get along and get on together. So it's unfortunate that we have these fights breaking out, but it's also fortunate that with the magnitude of the devastation, we really haven't lost a whole lot in the grand scheme of things.
Have you seen the destruction? Have you been out and about, Joey?
Yeah, I've seen water flowing over streets. Friends and family had houses destroyed and whatnot. But at the end of the day, you can rebuild a house, but you can't bring somebody back to life. And also, at the end of the day, when you come together and help out your neighbor, it makes the community stronger as a whole in the end. Hopefully. That's the goal, at least.
You know, in Japan, they've got a long, even ancient history of earthquakes and dealing with that. I mean, maybe part of it, Joey, is that New Jersey isn't, despite Irene last year, this, and it, of course they've had storms, but this scale of storm is not exactly something folks in New Jersey have to deal with all the time.
Well, I wouldn't say it's because they don't deal with storms and things. I would say it's more of a cultural thing where the Asian culture is more in touch with the society before the individual, whereas American culture and Western culture is me, and the individual first most of the time.
Joey, be safe in Cape May, New Jersey. Amy Nutt, are New Jerseyans cut out for this this kind of storm challenge?
Yeah, I think Governor Christie would probably say they certainly were. I mean, look, you're absolutely right. New Jerseyans aren't used to tsunamis and even earthquakes, although we did have a mild one last year right before Irene.
Yep.
But, you know, there are any number of you know, acts of kindness that people have been performing in, you know, walking up 17 flights of stairs to deliver meals.
Yep.
And, you know, looking out for a 94-year-old. I talked to a woman in Westfield. Her 94-year-old neighbor came to check on her,
hey,
see if she was okay.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the week of Sandy, survivor stories here, damage done, lessons learned in the superstorm. Amy Nutt is with us from the Star Ledger in Newark, New Jersey. Kate Zernike is with us, national correspondent for the New York Times, who's been covering New Jersey storm damage all week long. Ellis Hannigan is here, columnist at Newsday in New York City with us today. Of course, stories that go well beyond. Here's El Mosri writes to us from Burlington, Vermont, he says, unaffected by the storm, but had just launched a new website when Sandy hit. Their website developer lived in Hoboken, New Jersey. We needed help with a new site. He had no power, so they jumped in the car, went down, got him. The middle of the night brought him back to Vermont. All went well. Lots of closed roads, but no traffic in Jersey City at 2:30 a.m. He's now warm and dry in Burlington, but Hoboken still wet as can be. Ellis, here's one for you. Thinking Five writes to us, Staten Island should have been forced to evacuate. Every storm there are people who just won't leave areas predicted to be hardest hit in the future. A place for them to evacuate to and a way out should be mandatory. Ellis, can you imagine evacuating all of Staten Island?
Yeah, good luck with that. And Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan when you're done. Tom, I've been in New York a long time, but come originally from New Orleans and still have a big family down there. You know, when I came up here, I figured I'd left all that kind of stuff behind.
Yeah.
But if there's a lesson in this for people, I think it's that wherever you are, these things are coming, right? People in New York, we always felt like we were safe from this kind of event. But here we are, here it is, and now all of a sudden we're dealing with it. I'm not sure that there's anywhere in America at this point where some kind of disaster, maybe even an unexpected one, is something that you can simply say, that ain't happening here.
Well, I mean, we've always had disasters, and they've always been all over, but the intensity seems heightened. People talking climate change and global warming, whether it's flooding in New Jersey this week or wildfires in the West after the drought there. Kate, are you hearing that kind of talk as you move around New Jersey? Maybe people are more worried about the flooding right under their feet than the planetary situation, but does it come up, climate change?
You know, I have to say it comes up in a couple of reader emails that I get, but it really doesn't come up in interviews. Along the boardwalk, people are still, as you said earlier, have this incredible nostalgia, incredible romance about the Jersey Shore towns in particular, and they're not yet reckoning with the idea that maybe we shouldn't be building on these small slivers of sand. But I would just disagree with Ellis on one bit. I think, look, I grew up in Connecticut, and the town where I grew up once had an amusement park on the beach, and it was whacked out in the great hurricane of 1938. And if you remember, there are actually great pictures online of Catherine Hepburn's home in northern Connecticut that was wiped out in the storm of 1938. I mean, we did have these storms before. There was a great storm in 1992. In New Jersey, there was the Ash Wednesday storm of 1962. I think the point is that maybe they're coming more regularly. I think Amy mentioned earlier, someone did, about the earthquake that hit the Jersey Shore last year in the same week as Hurricane Irene.
Yeah. Let's go to Jamie in Columbia, South Carolina. Jamie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was in Hurricane Katrina, and the things that I'm hearing are sounding so similar. People talking about waiting in lines and people getting in fights and things like that. And I think what's sad is the fact that people on the outside don't realize what everyone is going through, how long you're waiting in a line just to get gas, just to go to McDonald's. I mean, it's unreal.
Yeah, fair enough to remember and remember again. I mean, I had my taste of it this week, all week long with no power at the house, big tree down and power out on my block. But Amy, it's true. You know, thinking about big issues and big picture and long sweeps of time when you're just trying to get something for the family to eat or a little gas for the generator, it's hard to look ahead at this point.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think people are very much concentrating on, where are they going to get the next hot meal or, frankly, hot shower. It's hard to think about, obviously, things like global climate change the greater good, because people are struggling. Just there's no relief. Even if you're able to get to work, getting home again is another issue. And then when you get home, do you even have power? So it's this kind of a global morass just a little bit of despair that has set in, and that's with people you know, many of the people inland, unlike as Kate talks about, the people all along the Barrier Islands and the Jersey Shore whose houses were swept out to sea, you know, in towns where there's now 4 feet of sand that's been left behind. And people worried on the Barrier Islands about the nor'easter that's expected next week and what that might add to the misery going on there.
What about, Kate, what are you hearing about how long digging up from this is going to take? I mean, it's one thing when you get hit and it's a little margin of the community or the state. But here, when you've got damage right to the heart of New Jersey's infrastructure and economy, what does that mean for recovery, Kate?
Well, I think it's going to be in stages. You know, power around the state is coming back slowly, very slowly. But until we get power, the gas problem is still going to be, you know, the way Amy described it earlier, these three-hour lines. And it's not that they can't get gas. Stations that have power can get gas, but there are tons of stations out there that just don't have any power to tap what's in their tanks. So that's one problem. So the power has to come back on. Certainly rebuilding on the Jersey Shore is just an enormous challenge. I mean, we're now looking at the city of Newark has canceled schools. They've had no school this week, and they've canceled it for Monday and Tuesday of next week. So, I mean, it really is sputtering back. I think the biggest challenge will be the repair, the rebuilding along the Jersey Shore, or just frankly getting people into homes, people who have lost their homes in the Jersey Shore, finding places for them. The electricity and the power will come back on soon, but in some places we're hearing that it won't be on until November 11th, which is a full week from now.
Boy, that's a long time. Long time. Christina in Accomack, Virginia. Christina, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just going to give a different perspective. We're down on the lower eastern shore of Virginia.
Yeah.
We're about a mile from the Chesapeake Bay and about a mile from the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
So we were definitely feeling the effects down here. And I must tell you, when we lost our power, the local radio station called Weezer, WESR,
okay.
had people calling in. And everybody knows everybody. It's a sparsely populated area. And I got a laugh from a man who called in. Everybody's a first name, and he said, well, Charlie, the water's coming up to the second step, very calmly.
Yeah.
He said, you know Tom next door, and everybody knows Tom. He says, yeah, his boat's floating. Oh, there goes my swing set.
Right.
There it goes. I'm watching it. Oh, good. It got caught on the flagpole.
Yeah. Safe. Well, it's almost funny until it's not, isn't it, Christina? And there go lives along with that as well, sort of real-time reporting on Sandy. Thank you for that, Christina. Bill in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just wanted to comment about the history of, you know, the storms that everybody seems to think this is something to do with global warming. And I can think back to the Ash Wednesday storm. The only difference I can see between New Jersey then and now is there's more people there.
What year was that, Bill?
I believe it was 62 or 63.
Yeah.
Don't remember exactly. But I went down to the shore. I had lived in Allentown, Pennsylvania at the time, and drove over to check it out because we always went to the beach, in the summertime down to the shore. And I don't really see much difference as far as the damage. And the other ones I can think of was Hurricane Camille, Hurricane Donna. I mean, there were many storms in the 50s and 60s. This is nothing new.
Well, it's certainly the case that there is a big history of big storms. Ellis, how do you hear people thinking about this now? Though, you know, we do have changing ocean temperatures. We have lost a good deal of the polar ice caps. The planets, wherever you want to pin it, the climate is changing. You've got the Bloomberg Business Week with its huge headline on the front, it's global warming, stupid, making the argument that economically we can't afford not to look at these amped up storms and their frequency and take that into account. Do you hear that conversation going on in New York City, Ellis?
Well, first, people want to get their power back, but you're right. We know that the sea levels are higher. We know that anecdotally that these things do seem like they're happening more often. And you know what? Maybe in the end, the cause of it, you know, is left to the politicians and the scientists and the academics. But maybe we just need to figure out what we're going to do about it. You know, do we need seawalls? Do we need levees in places that we never thought about levees before? How do we do that in a practical way? I promise you, that conversation is going to start really soon.
It seems as though, if Business Week has got it on its cover, all in caps, maybe the business community itself is starting to do the numbers and think twice about it. Chris is calling from the Jersey Turnpike. Chris, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you see?
Listen, I'm rolling up the turnpike from Baltimore. I'm seeing a lot of out-of-state plates. I just passed a long line of utility trucks from Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people concerned. I think when push comes to shove, we're some of the most altruistic people on the planet. I got a trunk full of gas for the community that I'm going to and a whole bunch of food. I think there's probably a lot of people out here just like me doing the same thing. And there's a lot of foreign out-of-state plates rolling up the turnpike, probably with a lot of help.
Bringing in help. Boy, I can attest to that. Tree down at my place all the way in Boston. The crew that took it away from South Carolina this week. So people really are on the move. Kate, have you seen that in New Jersey? Out-of-state utility crews and all the rest coming in to help.
Yeah, what was striking to me, especially having covered previous storms, was how really the state did manage in advance to get those trucks here. Before the storm came on Tuesday down by, on the shore, there were already trucks from Ohio and Texas. I think Governor Christie has mentioned help coming in from Indiana. I saw a picture this morning of just an entire parking lot of trucks having come in from all over the country, I think some from Michigan. So that is definitely true. A lot of these not only power trucks but also tree company trucks are coming through because, of course, one of the problems is we can't get to restore power until we clear these enormous trees that are
sure.
Downing some power lines.
Yeah, they are all over the place and way beyond New York and New Jersey on that front. David in Orlando, Florida, you're on the air, David.
Hi, Tom. I kind of surprised so many people are expecting so much so quickly. And if you're looking for gas and you only wait in line 2 hours, that's nothing. And not even if you're looking for gas 2 or 3 days past this, you've waited too long. And the fun doesn't start yet. I've been through the hurricanes in Florida like brushing your teeth. The fun is when insurance companies don't show up, when contractors don't show up. And this is going to go on for months. And why is it that so many Americans just sit there in a cocoon? I mean, you got to have a disaster plan no matter where you live in the country. My disaster plan, I go to Atlanta, is plan A. Plan B is Ohio. I have relatives there. And that's it. That's reality.
Well, it's been the reality for Florida for a long time. Maybe it's a reality dawning on the eastern seaboard further north, David. I don't know, Ellis. You see New Yorkers and folks in New Jersey going to wait hours and hours for gas and no problem. There's a pace of life issue and maybe a lack of familiarity with this scale of challenge.
It's probably true that many New Yorkers do not have the zen of the Japanese that one of the callers was describing a bit ago. But listen, we're resilient people. I mean, we're going to get through this part of it.
Mm-hmm.
The power will come back and the gas lines will go away. And slowly folks on the Jersey Shore will rebuild as people in Louisiana and Mississippi have mostly rebuilt along those stretches of coast. But, going forward, we really do have to answer some of these bigger questions.
I mean, the thing is, Kate, you've got such a concentrated – I mean, everybody's got an economy that's important. But in this area, you've got such a concentrated economic infrastructure. The idea of taking a long time for it to get back in gear – well, I mean, just the New Jersey Turnpike and just the commerce that travels on that alone, fairly essential to quite a large percentage of the country.
No, it's enormous. I mean, New Jersey is the most densely populated state in the country. They're just enormous. There's so many industries centered in New York City. I mean, centered in New York. Just the idea of having these roads closed is an enormous hit. I think we've already seen, there was a figure this morning, $50 million already. I mean, I think the hits are going to be huge.
We've got David calling from Somerville, Massachusetts, thinking about all this. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Okay. What do you think?
The lesson from this storm is really, in terms of our infrastructure, is really the same as the lesson of 9/11 and the one we didn't take, 12 years ago, which is that we need to harden our infrastructure. We need to localize it so that it doesn't have these fragile, attenuated links to other areas, and each area needs to be harder and more self-contained. We need to generate our power more locally, clean our wastewater more locally, generate our clean water more locally, so that the whole country would be more resilient in that way.
You know, we can kind of imagine that in some bucolic setting, but how do you do that in super dense New Jersey, or never mind New York, David?
It's easier to do it in an urban
is
setting.
It?
It's easier to do it in an urban setting. What you need to do is to break it down so that people don't have to commute, so that they can walk across the street to work, so that they live in a dense environment, but where each community is essentially self-sufficient and not dependent on water, power, waste removal from long distances.
Let us pick it up. Our time is short. Ellis, can you picture that? New York City breaking it down to sort of village scale, hardened infrastructure readiness? Or is that, I don't know, you've done things big for a long time.
I would give that kind of feeling maybe 3 weeks. I think 3 weeks from now we'll see maybe what we saw after a couple of months after 9/11, which was that we can all say that stuff, but in the end we get back to life and we go about our business and we live in places that maybe are a little dangerous. And, we make those choices in our lives and memories fade.
But what's it take to change a city's sense of where it sits in terms of its overall safety and security? You get Irene, you get Sandy. How many in a row does it take, for New York to say, we do have to make more substantial changes? Something's changed in the environment around us.
Here's hoping, but I would say that history shows us that we have to be whacked in the head maybe 3 or 4 or 47 times before we do.
Well, it's a big whack this week. Kate, where are you headed next to look around?
I'm going back to the shore.
Back to the shore where the devastation is just so incredible. And Amy Nutt, how about there in Newark? What's your next assignment?
Probably the same thing.
To the shore where the storm, Sandy, has come along with such ferocity and so much devastation. Amy Nutt with the Newark Star-Ledger, the Star-Ledger in Newark. Amy, thank you very much for being with us today. Your eyewitness report, we really appreciate it. Thanks, Amy.
Sure.
Kate Zernike with the New York Times all over New Jersey. Thanks for being with us, Kate.
Thanks, Tom.
Ellis Hennigan, play it safe, stay safe, stay dry. Thanks for being with us, Ellis.
Thank you for doing this.
Ellis Hennigan of Newsday. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.